I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. More than 70,000 Americans died in 2017 due to drug overdoses. In the Midwest, there was a 70% increase in fatalities from July 2016 to September 2017. Today, a story that goes behind the statistics. A Kansas City man who lost not one, but two siblings to opioid addiction and almost lost his own battle. We'll find out what finally convinced him to kick the life-threatening habit. Then we revisit our conversation with a college professor who tells of the rare and wonderful friendship she developed with one of her students and how, over time, she learned more from him than she ever could have imagined. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Every day, more than 130 people in this country die after overdosing on opioids. Nicholas Bush was lucky he hasn't been one of them. For years, Nick lived his life by using drugs to deal with the challenges that so many of us face. But over time, he found himself doing things that he never imagined he would do, like burglarizing homes. For a time, it was exciting and even cool. But then the death count began to mount. Over time, he lost seven loved ones to drugs, including his sister and brother. Nicholas Bush lived at rock bottom for years, but lived to tell his story in a new book, One by One, a memoir of love and loss in the shadows of opioid America. He now lives in Kansas City. And Nick, it's nice to have you here. Welcome.
Thanks for having me on, Steve. Appreciate it.
Now, your book begins with a kick. You write this in your first sentence: I am hiding from detectives in my parents' basement. It's not the first time. Mm-hmm. What was going on there?
Well, Steve, thanks again for having me. What was going on was, I was a heroin addict. had been doing drugs for about 10 years. Started at about 14, like so many of us do, just partying and going with the flow of the crowd, peer pressure, things like that. It really wasn't anything out of the ordinary. But I found that when I got into using like marijuana and stuff like that at that age, I was different than most people. I just kind of wanted to do that all the time. And it became sort of a coping mechanism. I had triggers I didn't really know about. And going down that path, it only got worse. And so, eventually, as you said, I start my book with that sort of climactic moment where I'm hiding from two detectives in my mom's basement for crimes related to my heroin addiction.
And eventually, they caught up with you, right?
That's correct. They sure did. And I was tired of running. And it all came to a head. I was headed to prison. For crimes, like I said, related to my heroin addiction. It just really seemed like there was no way out. And I was almost relieved. I just wanted it to end. I didn't want to hide anymore.
Yeah.
But I was terrified of going to prison.
Mm-hmm. For a good reason, right? Yeah.
Absolutely.
I opened the show by talking about opioids, and that's the word that's in your title. You're talking about heroin. What's the connection there? Because there sort of is a connection for a lot of opioid users.
Yeah. Yes, definitely. With heroin, it's almost like there's a generational gap. It's like middle-aged people and up kind of see heroin addicts as, like bums on the street type of a thing. And the younger generation is facing the opioid epidemic, which is caused by like pharmaceutical companies, which are prescribing really strong opiates. And heroin is an opiate. And, I lost my sister to that very thing. And, they didn't struggle. She didn't struggle with drugs. My brother, I also lost. He didn't struggle with drugs. But once she was prescribed the opiates, she went down that path also. And really, I'm trying to raise awareness here and show people that there are alternatives to opiates. She didn't have the triggers I did with abuse and stuff coming up. But just doing opiates like one time really did send her down that path. And she lost her life to heroin a couple years later.
So a lot of folks like yourself, you start off taking pills, opiates, mm-hmm. and then you transition to heroin. Why?
That's a good question. It's almost
it's cheaper for one thing, isn't it?
Absolutely. And it's actually it can be easier to get with the opioids. I've seen people who go doctor shopping and they just aren't able to get what they need. And so they resort to trying to find heroin eventually.
Yeah. Just a second ago, you mentioned there are alternatives to opioids.
Yes.
What are you talking about?
Nerve pain medication. There are medications out there that are non-addictive. You know, they don't really get you high. That's the catch. And that's really what we're talking about here, is getting high. You know, these drugs that the pharmaceutical companies are putting out there, that's what one of the side effects are, is, you know, just really feeling euphoric. And they're addictive, okay? And there are non-addictive, you know, albeit, you know, non-euphoric stuff that really won't get you high. But, you know, it's not going to ruin your life. You can use it while you're recovering from surgery and stuff like that, and put it down with no problems.
So the fact that these manufacturers are making these opioids, these opiates, I'm just guessing here. Yeah, it must have a lot of anger at what these companies are doing. The lawsuits are flying. Mm-hmm. The settlements are all over the place in state after state right now. And you were a victim of this, Nick.
Yes. That's right. I've been told to sue the Sackler family and that I would win. I've been told there's, you know, possibly, you know, millions out there, lawyers and stuff like that want to talk to me.
Why not?
My focus is on the individuals. I want to bring healing. I want to bring hope to the people who are struggling. I don't think any amount of money can heal my broken heart from losing my brother and sister. What will do it, though, is helping others.
Yeah. And that's what the reason you wrote this book, and that's what your journey is all about.
Yes, absolutely.
You know, tell us a little bit about these highs, because you describe them in pretty graphic detail. And I got a word here in my notes somewhere that I can't grab real quickly, but these things just sent you soaring in ways that it's almost impossible to describe, but give it a shot for us.
You're talking about the effects of physical effects?
Yeah, and how they made you feel.
Okay. Yeah, well, with heroin, it's people who do, you know, you find yourself where you never thought you would, wanting heroin. And so you say, okay, well, I'm just going to put everything aside and just, I need this. I don't care what stipulations there are. I'm just going to go for it. And when I tried it, it's so difficult. I found myself doing a touchdown dance in my living room, and it was like just too much dopamine. And you know, it just changed my brain chemistry and set me on a crazy spree of just, you know, that's what my life became about after doing heroin one time. I thought to myself, if I could just find a dead-end job and be able to, you know, support this heroin addiction, I'd be totally fine with that. I'd be happy.
Wow. You said on the Today Show that addicts are made, they're not born. Mm. What did you mean by that?
You know, for me, I had a lot of triggers from a very abusive upbringing. I was kind of the scapegoat in my family. And that had a lot to do with, you know, I was turned into an addict because of that abuse. That's one way. Another way, though, was with my sister and brother. They didn't have that experience, but they became physically addicted. I think that pharmaceutical companies know this. I think they're more. It's been well documented that they have lied, and they knew that these were addictive substances, and billed them as non-addictive, quote unquote, miracle drugs. Talking about OxyContin there.
Yeah.
And they've been, you know, they've settled. One time it was for over $500 million.
Yeah. Our phone number here, if you want to join our conversation with Nicholas Bush, again, his new book, One by One, A Memoir of Love and Loss in the Shadows of Opioid America. Nick now lives in the Kansas City area. Our number, 816-235-2888, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. I want to read this, something you wrote in USA Today that talks about the power of this stuff. You wrote this, Nick: I was in and out of jail 5 times and on probation twice. I was brought in for questioning, often in handcuffs, more times than I can remember. At various points, I was homeless, held at gunpoint, robbed, had my apartment ransacked more than once, and I was in rehab twice. Two of my family members and 3 of my friends died from heroin overdoses, and I've had 2 near-fatal ones myself. Yeah. With the related diseases and paralysis that accompany heroin use, it's a miracle I'm still alive.
Yes.
But none of that, you point out, stopped your addiction. I mean, for those of us who've never been there before, that's really hard to wrap our arms around.
It is.
Maybe that's part of the issue here with the struggle to stop this stuff.
Yeah, and it's a disease. That's what it is, and it does make no logical sense. You know, it's killing your friends, your family. It's killing you, and here you are wanting it more than ever. It changes your brain chemistry. Addiction is, it's, you know, in the addiction community, there are people who don't really want to accept it, but the fact is, it is a proven disease. You know, you can classify it different ways, like mental illness, behavioral illness, things like that.
Yeah.
But you can study it, you can map it in the brain, and you know, I've a lot of doctors doctors have kept me up to date on this. They say things like, you know, 16% of Americans are susceptible to becoming drug addicts if they were to try opiates just once. That's the, you know, official figure from, I think it's like, they make sure to keep me up to date on this stuff. But 16% of Americans are susceptible. They say if you just try it one time, you can become addicted. And
that's just amazing.
Yeah.
But you even started burglarizing homes. Mm-hmm. Tell us about the first time. What made you go there?
Well, you know, like I said, I was abused a lot, and I was bitter. I began stealing from my own home, my parents, mm-hmm. to get back at them. And, mm-hmm. you know, it worked. I got away with it. And so I, my goodness, it's in my diseased way of thinking. I was like, well, if I can get away with it here, what's going to stop me from getting away with it, you know, next door when, you know, nobody's home? And it just, it's hard for me to even think about, let alone talk about. But yes, I did go down that path, and I almost went to prison for it.
I mean, there's a connection between getting hooked and difficult childhoods that you've alluded to here. And certainly yours fit that category. What happened to you?
Well, you know, it really doesn't make much sense, but I've been told, you know, I'm kind of the scapegoat of my family, and I think abuse is something that's really hidden, much like addiction, and bringing that to the light and talking about it has really shaken up a lot of things in my family, but really, it's what allows healing to begin to happen, is to face these things head on and get it to the light, because trying to hide my child abuse and whoever out there is listening to this, you know, trying to bury those things, maybe you were raped, maybe you were, you know, abused some way. It's what's facilitating unhealthy ways of thinking. And, you know, if you're into drugs and stuff like that, it's really going to serve as a catalyst for sending you down that path.
You know, there were any number of moments with your father that might qualify as breaking points, but certainly one came one morning when you and your buddy Giovanni were mm-hmm. out washing with the wheel rims mm-hmm. off your dad's car mm-hmm. using just the soap and water that he allowed you to do this with. And at one point, your buddy Giovanni just sort of stands up and rebels against this work that your dad's forcing the two of you to do and says, I'm done. I ain't doing this anymore. Yeah. And then what followed was pretty unbelievable. What happened?
Well, my dad spiked his shot glass and charged out there and, you know, knocked me over and began hitting me in the face.
Knocked Giovanni over.
And Giovanni charged into him, getting him off of me, and we just started rolling around and fighting. It was like something straight out of a WWE wrestling match, you know, right in the front, in the suburbs. You know, I'm from, like, the upper class, and, you know, my neighbors are all, you can see them kind of, like, looking out. They're screaming, what the heck is going on over there? My mom comes out, get off of them, they're going to call the police. And, you know, just, I was so relieved that my plight had been discovered by a friend of mine, because I just didn't know how to talk about this stuff to anybody, you know?
What opioids does to the human body. That's our topic here. Our guest, Nicholas Bush, he's the author of One by One, a memoir of love and loss in the shadows of opioid America. He now lives in Kansas City. Let's go to some calls at 816-235-2888. MK from Independence. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you, Steve?
I'm well. Thanks for calling, MK.
All right. Without sounding insensitive, because I am not, to the plight and things that he has gone through, there's one thing I noticed. I have to use opioid medications. And in the news, we only hear about the bad things that happen, but we hear nothing for the people who have to use this for a livelihood. Mm-hmm. Now, I got sick in 1991. I was disabled by 1999. And I've had to use these medications for years. And because of all the media hype about it causing death and people being addicted, doctors are reluctant to deal with me because of my illness and what they'd have to give to me.
MK, give me a question for Nick here.
Well, Nick, I questioned, because I really just wanted to make a statement.
Okay,
so everybody
sure.
knew it's just not about...
Well, let me have Nick react to what MK
yeah,
is saying.
No, I,
there.
I do have a comment for him.
Yeah.
MK, yeah, no, I was in the hospital for, I dislocated my shoulder, and I was in, I don't know if you've had that happen, I was in screaming pain for hours. I was screaming at the top of my lungs in the ER. They were struggling to get it under control to be able to pop it back in. They had to use opioids, and this was, you know, fairly recently. I had to have that was the only thing that would do it. And so, you know, I do think there are places for it in the medical industry. But unfortunately, in my personal opinion, MK, I think it's gotten pretty out of control with overly prescribing it to the public.
How was it for you going back on them? How risky was that?
It was just at that moment in the ER. Okay. It wasn't, they didn't prescribe me anything.
Yeah. Katie from Prairie Village. Katie, you're on Up to Date.
Hi, I'm Katie. Hi, Nick.
Hello.
I'm 71, and I have a 40-year-old son who was addicted to heroin for about 10 years. He started when he was 14, but he never had prescription drugs or opiates. He had an older buddy, and they stole morphine from the buddy's grandmother, who was in hospice, and he started shooting it, and he got onto heroin, and that lasted until he had to go to the county jail in St. Louis for a year.
Yeah.
And after that, he was able to get into a methadone program. And I think that methadone and Suboxone are absolutely terrific drugs for people that do have that opiate dependence. I have it myself. There's not a day that I don't crave oxycodone. I used to take my brother's OxyContin when we could abuse it by chewing it up. You can't do that anymore.
Yeah.
So there it is. What do you think about methadone?
You know, methadone clinics, I think Suboxone is better than methadone. With methadone, it's like, you know, I should start by saying I don't have any personal experience with methadone. I just have dealt with people who do. It seems like it's just trading one addiction for another. In my personal opinion, you know, if that's helping you, I'm, you know, good for you. That's something that I just think is trading one addiction for another. And I would encourage people to seek out whatever avenues are necessary in order to not have to rely on, you know, any drugs to be sober.
I was really struck at one point in the book, you talk about an additive or something the manufacturers had added to Oxy, I think it was, mm-hmm. so that you could no longer crush it up. But mm-hmm. you and your friends and maybe others discovered that if you, I forget again the details here, but if you crush it up and then you freeze it and then you bake it for 7 minutes,
yeah.
you can still, you know, regain the high that the crushed stuff could give you. How in the world did you discover that it would take like 7 minutes of baking it, that was precisely what was needed to get you going again?
Yeah, so we were really into the OxyContin at that time. And
Oxy was the preferred. That was the thing. That was the drug.
Government heroin. Government heroin, dog. I got that. That's what they would say. so, you know, at first you just crush it up, snort it. It was great. It was just like heroin. Then you crush it up, snort it, nothing happens. Then you can't crush it up at all. And so... the next thing we know, it's just they just knew. Like, these people have fake X-rays. They have a million different doctors. They I don't know how they know these things. I don't know if they get the information from the doctors. I have no idea. But these drug addicts who, you know, are hopelessly addicted to these drugs, and that's their entire life. That's all they do. That's how they make their income. And, you know, it's no way to live, certainly. But they knew exactly what to do. Like I said, that's what they're into. That's their entire life. That addiction has completely taken over their world. And that's really all they think and talk about. You know, it's even easier when you're in it that deep. It's even easier to find than things like pot, because, you know, people who smoke weed and stuff like that, they, for the most part, have like a normal life. You can't really tell just by looking at them, right? So
right.
With heroin and stuff, though, in Oxy, it's like, that's all they do. It's you make one phone call, boom, it's there. It's like crazy.
You describe one incident going into the basement of a dealer's home on a rough side of town, I think.
Chicago.
Chicago on the south side, I think. And you're down there and, you know, you're buying some weed and you're buying some Oxy, mm-hmm. I think. And your way out the door, you flash the victory symbol or something like that. And there was some thought that maybe you were signaling a police officer and a guy drew down on you.
Yep.
Scary or did that just a moment in the life of an addict?
Man, my life, I really tried to put in my book things like that really show the reader what it feels like, what it smells like, what it tastes like, what it looks like, what it hears like to be walking in the shoes of, you know, someone who's deep in addiction and facing the opioid epidemic head on and stuck in it, and more importantly, how I came out of it. That's something I really want to put some words to and show people. But to answer your question, you know, yeah, I was in that basement and I was just kind of nervous because these guys were hardcore thugs, hardcore gang members. And I was there with my buddy Giovanni. And, you know, he's in that realm. He's Italian. And, you know, his dad's from Naples. And I'll say the word La Cosa Nostra, and that's really all I got to say about that. But, you know, leaving there, I was kind of nervous. I've never dealt with, like, those type of people, like black gang members, like complete thugs, you know. And,
right.
And he has. And so we're down there. I just went with him that one time. And so we're leaving. And like I said, I was kind of nervous. I just was didn't know what to do. I threw up a peace sign, like, hey, see you guys later. And they look at me and they pull out their gun. They're like, white boy. Like, it was, you know, if it down there, if you flash a sign, you're going to get shot at. If you have the wrong color hat on, you're going to get shot at. Chicago is very violent. And it's not like any other place you can even imagine. It's like more right. people die in there from gun violence than, you know, Afghanistan. It's crazy.
The impact of opioids, that's our topic here. 816-235-2888 is our phone number. You can tweet us at KCUR up to date. So how did you begin to pull out of it? What's the redemption story here, Nick? Because we need to get there.
Sure. My sister died, like I said, from a heroin overdose. She was prescribed the opiates for a rare condition, shingles. You know, it's usually found in elderly people, but she got that, and, you know, she was taking opioids. She died from resorting to heroin, you know, like I said. And about 6 months after she died, you know, I didn't realize how much I loved her until she was gone. And that was just eating me up inside. And I, you know, I really didn't want to live anymore. And, you know, I was just homeless and kind of, like, strung out on just drugs, just trying to kill the pain, and just drinking constantly and getting intoxicated all the time, every day, every night. And so my parents didn't know what to do with me. I was just living off of them in their basement. They put me out on the street, and you got to get out of here. You got to figure your stuff out. It's been 6 months since she's passed. You can't keep living here like this. And so at my lowest point, one night when I was asleep, I found myself face to face with her, and it was unlike any other dream. She told me, you know, we got to have a little conversation. It was amazing. It was like, you know, I miss you so much. I didn't know how much I loved you. And yeah, you know, everything's gonna be all right. And I asked her, you know, what do I do? I'm at a loss. I don't know what to do. And she looked at me straight in the eye and she said, love Christ. And then I woke up, and it was, you know, sometimes you have a dream and where you think like, was that real? No, it was just a dream. It was just a dream. Okay.
Right.
Didn't really happen. Okay.
But this one,
this was
sure.
different, dude. This will stick with me for the rest of my life. This was a very vivid vision that happened to happen while I was asleep. And so, you know, I was rocked. Like, I didn't care anything about, what Jesus or Christ or God or any religion, you know, none of that stuff. And didn't grow up, you know, like I said, grew up doing drugs a lot and stuff like that, so I didn't care about that. And so it made me kind of bitter. I was like, okay, so I guess, you know, all of a sudden it's like God is real and stuff. So it sent me kind of for a loop, but man, yeah, I really did. I saw her, and I knew what she said. So it was a matter of time before I started going down that path, and I'm very grateful to be able to say that that is the reason why I'm sitting here talking to you today, Steve.
What would you advise parents? We had a caller earlier who said, you know, had a younger son who'd been addicted for 10 years. Mm-hmm. What's a parent to do, Nick?
You know, I should start by saying that you're suffering as a parent probably more than your child is. And, you know, the loved ones of these addicts, you don't have to be a parent. You know, the brothers, the sisters, the friends, the uncles, the aunts, the loved ones are the ones who are suffering. You're the one who is suffering the most, to be honest. Mm-hmm. And so I would say you've really got to get some support for yourself. That's got to be step one. And so from there, you know, they'll be able, in the support recovery community, they're very, very caring, very active. And they'll take care of you, like I just said. And they'll be able to, you know, work on you with like an individual case-by-case basis. That's what they do. That's what they're there for. And I just want to encourage you to step out and get out of your comfort zone. And, you know, reach out for some support. There are others going through the same thing. And, you know, fellowship and connection in that can be, is awesome.
You know, there's this enormous societal backlash now, legal backlash against the manufacturers. Mm-hmm. You know, the New York Attorney General's office this week has filed a lawsuit against 6 opioid manufacturers. You know, what do you make of it? Is it going to be enough? I got like a minute left.
Oh, boy. Something's got to give here. You know, we can't keep going on like this with 70 to 100,000 people per year dying in just America alone from opioid overdoses. That's not just, you know.
So is the backlash legally, is it changing the scene?
You know, I've done a lot of these shows, and out on the East Coast, they tell me, you know, Nick, this is awesome because for the first time, we're seeing numbers go down. It's starting to change. We are seeing improvement. And it's honestly, it's the hardest hit areas like New Jersey, Philadelphia, that are saying these things. And so that's encouraging. I think people just, you know, being aware that taking opioids like one time can send you down the path to like death. And it sucks, but it's the truth.
Nicholas Bush is the author of One by One, a memoir of love and loss in the shadows of opioid America. Nice to have you here. Welcome to Kansas City. It's great to have you here. Good
Thanks
luck to you, Nick.
Thank you.
Coming up, the story of a rare friendship. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR 89.3. Yesterday on the show, friends of Morton Sosland recalled the businessman and philanthropist who died last week. Hear how he impacted the Kansas City community at kcur.org/uptodate. Next week on Up to Date, UMKC was recently added to the list of colleges that experienced clashes between invited speakers and protesters. We'll discuss how schools should handle free speech on campus next week on Up to Date. When it comes to friendship, the one we heard about last November was pretty special. So special, we thought it was worth bringing to you again. Here it is. Sarah Rule is an accomplished playwright. She's a two-time Pulitzer finalist and a Tony Award nominee. So why did Rule change her response to a poet's application to her playwriting class at Yale from a no to a yes? As Rule writes in the introduction to Letters from Max, a book of friendship, it is hard to imagine now that Max's application could ever have remained in any other pile, a strange parallel universe in which I never met Max. To tell us why she made that switch and about the friendship that ensued, Sarah Rule joins me now from the studios of NPR in New York City. Sarah, welcome to Up to Date. It's so nice to have you.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure.
Well, why did you change your mind about Max Ritvo's application?
Well, I reread his application, and the reason he had been in the no pile was that he'd never written a play before, and it was an advanced playwriting class. But he said in his application that he was a poet and a comedian. And I think poets who are funny are a rare and amazing species of human being. Mm-hmm. And I also think that plays in a funny way are a combination of poetry and comedy, or they can be. If they have the lift of humor and the lift of language, that can become a play. So I thought, I'm going to try out Max Ritvo. He sounds really interesting.
Tell us about the first time he walked into your classroom. I mean, describe what you saw and what struck you about Max.
Well, Max, he was such an old soul, and he had read absolutely everything. I mean, he had read ancient Vedic texts. He had read contemporary poetry. And he, the way he put words together was incredibly arresting in the way that, you know, a genius poet can put two words together. And he was also very funny. He sort of reminded me of a young Mike Nichols or an old John Keats. And he loved making people laugh.
You know, the book consists of this correspondence between the two of you over the years, and it began pretty quickly once he was in your class. In one of his earliest emails, he revealed that he had some health issues. What did he tell you?
Well, his first letter to me, he was basically asking if he could miss class one Friday because he'd gotten tickets to Einstein on the Beach at Brooklyn Academy of Music.
And you were okay with that.
I was like, great, I was dying to go to that. But you have to do a report on it and you know, give the report to the class. And I said, maybe you could come to half the class and then go to Brooklyn Academy of Music. And Max said, well, I can't because I have to eat in a really regimented way because I had chemotherapy as a result of the Ewing sarcoma I had in high school. And it was then that I realized why Max was so skinny and partly why Max seemed so much more wise than the other 20-year-olds who surrounded him because he'd already contemplated these big questions of mortality.
You know, I love what you wrote about seeing him for the first time, that it was as though an ancient light bulb hovered over his head. I mean, facing cancer as a teen may have contributed to that, but did you sense, you know, there was something more there right away?
Yeah, I mean, quite simply, I think Max was a genius, and I think a lot of people who knew Max felt the same way. And One thing that was unique about him was he had a genius for poetry, but also for friendship and for listening and for being generous. And that's so, so rare.
So rare, yeah. You know, Max was a poet, and as you said, he had never written a play before. How did he do as a playwright in your class?
Well, he was great. I mean, I think, you know, it was almost like watching a chef who tries to be a pastry chef for a little while. I can read you a little bit maybe of one of his plays if you want.
Sure. What page are you going to? I have the book right here in front of me.
It's page 17.
Okay.
And it's about Max used to get tattoos post-surgery to make something beautiful out of something painful.
Mm-hmm.
And so he wrote a scene where a sick boy goes to get a new tattoo at a tattoo parlor where the tattoo artist is sort of like an analyst and they speak in iambic pentameter. And of course, I'd never seen a play where a tattoo artist speaks in iambic pentameter, which I thought was amazing. So the boy says to the tattoo artist, "So I have brought inside my little pouch a little draft of a hokusai crane." The reference to this is that he had bird tattoos for every surgery, but they each referenced a different artist.
Mm-hmm.
And then there are these stage directions that finish his play, and they read that the tattoo artist finishes and picks the boy up very gently like an angel helping another angel. Mm. She offers him a compact mirror gently like an angel offering a compact mirror to another angel. He smiles and begins to check it out. Then the boy says, "It's dope. I really love it in this light."
Yeah,
so I think it's
college kids don't write like that.
No,
I teach here too.
You do.
I wouldn't recognize that in my classes. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, that's just so amazing to me. You were a playwright who had written poetry earlier in your life, but then you had given it up. Max inspired you, and you started writing poems again. And I'm wondering why.
Yeah, he did. I mean, I've never totally given it up. I think poetry is one of those things that's very hard to give up, like being Catholic, which I also was born Catholic. I think it's sort of in your blood. But I mostly write poems, sort of occasional poems, as gifts for people, and I tend not to share them with other people. So Max both inspired me to write more poetry, but also to share the poems I'd already written. And I think Max had this uncanny effect on a lot of his teachers where you were sort of aware that you were with a colleague rather than a student pretty quickly in your relationship. And I know that wasn't unique to me and Max. I know he had that relationship with other teachers. And he also was very persuasive. So if Max said, "Will you show me one of your poems? You know, I love your poems best," then of course I'm going to send Max a poem. So in the sharing of, I would send Max a poem, he'd send me a poem, I'd send him a play, he'd send me a poem. And in that exchange, I ended up writing more poetry.
Hmm. Hey, had you ever experienced that kind of relationship with a student before?
I have loved so many students, you know, and had profound connections with them. I think there were a couple things that were unique about Max. And one thing was that when he had a recurrence of his cancer at the end of the semester, I think we all had this terrible sense of doom and that we might not have very long to spend with Max, you know, me and the teaching assistant and the rest of the class. Mm-hmm. And so there was this sense of urgency. And my teacher, for instance, Paula Vogel, who's the reason I write plays, has become like a family member. And, you know, she and her wife married me and my husband got frocked for the day. But this relationship took, you know, 25 years at this point. I've known Paula, you know, to become like family. And with Max, it felt like I would have known him for our whole lives, but I had to compress this friendship into a very short amount of time. Mm. So I think the urgency was something that made it different from other students where, you know, they graduate, I keep in touch, we get to know each other over time, and time took on a different tenor or speed with Max.
I'm visiting with Sarah Rule, a two-time Pulitzer finalist, about her new book, Letters from Max, A Book of Friendship. Over the course of the book, you know, Max was still battling the cancer and undergoing these rounds of treatment. Your exchanges during these times struck me as ranging from the practical to the poetic, from soup to spirituality, if you will. You offer distraction and support in your letters, and I'm wondering, what did you get from his letters?
I mean, so much joy, really. And Max was so funny. He had such an extraordinary mind. And as you said, it encompassed everything from soup to metaphysics. And I think with Max, there was a sense that you could share things with him, matters of the spirit, matters of the mind, and he would take them with almost a practical seriousness. You know, you could talk about your spiritual conversion or epiphany in the same way that other people might make small talk about the weather. And Max was never interested in small talk. So I think he offered me a galvanizing listening spirit, you know, in the way that every good friendship does, where you feel like you can tell a friend something that you can't tell everyone.
Wow. You exchange poems as well. I mean, is there one of Max's that you'd like to read for our listeners?
I would love to. I mean, there's so many I would love to read, but I think I'm going to read this one because he wrote it for me, and he said it was inspired by seeing one of my plays. That was the other amazing thing with Max, was there was so much synchronicity where he would see a play and he would write a poem about it. You know, there was this generative quality.
What page are you going to here, sir?
This is 55.
Okay.
And so the play was called The Oldest Boy, and in it two people are washing dishes together and sort of have this intimacy and quiet between them. So it's called Refuge for Sarah. Rain falls on the house. My mother dries dishes in the dark house in the rain. I'm your little dish, I tell her, even though I ought to be a man. You're a big dish. You mean I'm very wet? I haven't seen much and don't see much. The jungle of my short life is one row of white straight naked trees. The vines are white and fall apart in my hands as if dissolved under the tongue. Every living thing is screaming dust. To imagine a heaven is to admit there are things in this world you think you could never bring yourself to love, even given an unlimited number of attempts. Learn to love everything. The world becomes heaven. That sounds hard. I have a better idea. Pass the soap. I tell you now, unhappily knitted to bravery, that all you must do is hate yourself round and round, hand in hand, foaming mouth open, rainbow bubbles dashing open. Hate yourself more than any other thing. You have made heaven. I'll stop there. Excuse me.
You know, there's just such a sophistication to what he was able to produce that is really jaw-dropping for a young man of that age.
Oh, incredibly jaw-dropping. And the other thing is, so he published this book called Four Reincarnations. It's also Milkweed Editions. And they rushed the galleys through so that he was able to hold them in his hands before he died. And then this extraordinary thing happened, which is between the time he published his first full-length book and the time he died, which wasn't very long at all, he had written enough new poems that Louise Glick, one of his mentors, really his primary mentor at Yale, was able to edit a posthumous collection called Final Voicemails, which is really stunning, which is also out recently. And usually it takes a poet, you know, a year or two to finish a second book after a first book. But Max was just writing all the time.
Well, not to be morbid here, but there's nothing like a deadline, right? I mean, that's what helps.
It's morbid, but it's true.
It's true, sure.
He was writing against time. He was writing with time. He was writing with all the time that he had.
Yeah. You know, you mentioned Louise Gluck, his MFA advisor at Columbia, and she wrote this of him. He was in a hurry. He was dying, though he always carried with him the audacity of real hope. Was that hope about beating the cancer, or was it maybe something, an expectation, something bigger that he had for himself?
I think it was bigger. There's a quote in Letters from Max that maybe I'll just read to you because I think it's kind of extraordinary. Watch me mispronounce his name. The Polish poet Milosz says, a Greek word, storge, denotes a tender care, affection uniting parents and children. Perhaps some teachers feel such a love for their pupils. It is also not impossible that storge may be applied to the relationship between a poet and generations of readers to come. Underneath the ambition to perfect one's art without hope of being rewarded by contemporaries lurks a magnanimity of gift offering to posterity. Mm-hmm. And that, to me, was Max's hope. You know, this buoyant hope that he might not live to see the day where readers would be affected by his work, but that there was this buoyant hope for posterity, you know, this incredible ambition that his words would be immortal.
Again, I'm visiting with Sarah Rule about her new book, Letters from Max, A Book of Friendship. You say that, you know, in time, Sarah, your relationship changed to where Max became the student and you, Max became the teacher and you the student.
Yeah.
What are some of the things that you ultimately wound up learning from him?
So many things. I mean, I think being present to the moment, really being in the moment, was one thing. He had such...
So hard for so many of us to do, right?
Oh, God, and our culture at every turn leads us away from the present moment. And Max had this direct gaze, really a transparent gaze. And when you were with him, he was absolutely with you in the present tense. And I remember one time we were at a cafe in Brooklyn, and he said, I'd like to read a poem out loud to you. And I said, really? And he said, yeah. And he said, please rise. It was like this little cafe. And so I got up and Max read me the poem in this booming voice. And I was slightly embarrassed and because, you know, I'm from the Midwest.
I would be, too.
Yeah. We don't do such things. And then afterwards, we were walking out and I said, oh, that's a beautiful poem. I'm sorry if I was slightly embarrassed. And he said, oh, God, you were embarrassed. I'm so sorry. He was so apologetic. And I said, no, not embarrassed in the wrong way, but in the Elizabeth Bishop sense of embarrassed as in not wanting to look at something directly. And I think one thing I learned from Max was, you know what, just be demonstrative. We don't have time. There's no time to not tell people who you love that you love them, whether they're friends, family, romantic partners, teachers, students, former teachers. Like, be demonstrative, 'cause you don't know. You don't know how much time you have.
You know, he comes across as so open, so very open and humorous and affectionate, just maybe in the end, just very Max. Mm-hmm. Did it take much getting used to, or did people just get sort of caught up in the wave that was Max here?
I think people got caught up in the wave that was Max. I mean, he was so galvanizing and so so full of life. I mean, he would be post-surgery. After lung surgery, and he would be saying, please don't make me laugh, like that's the most painful thing right now. But he also loved to laugh. And I remember tales when he was at Yale as an undergraduate, someone told me that he would do these kind of floating parades where he and his friends would put on headphones and listen to music and dance and parade through the campus, and no one knew what the dance was to because it was on headphones. You know, and he would, when he would give readings, he would wear a pink kimono often. It was like his good luck kimono. And, you know, I read sort of in a retiring voice, but Max read in this big, booming, performative voice. And if there were other people on stage, I remember one reading he gave was so packed, people were on stage with him. And so he rotated wearing this pink kimono so that he was taking the whole audience in.
So by the end of his life, people were getting it in terms of this was somebody of significance.
Absolutely. Yes. I mean, I think he was making a literary mark, and he knew that while he was alive.
That must have been extremely gratifying for him.
I think it really was. I mean, I think it was, you know, in the summer before he died, he had a poem to my litter, published in The New Yorker, really a beautiful poem, and it was accompanied by an animation. I think Max was too sick to read it, so they to do a video, so they animated Max reading the poem. It just was beautiful, and Max could see the effect it was having on readers.
You know, you mentioned these public readings that you two would sometimes do together. Did Max have to work pretty hard to get you, to convince you to get up in front of an audience and do your thing with him?
Well, as I said, Max was very persuasive.
Yeah.
So pretty much when he asked,
when
he asked, I'd say, okay. You know, I used to have a fear of reading poetry in public. Like, really, I would shake and tremble, and I just couldn't bear it. I just wanted to disappear. And you know, Max made it seem like no big deal. So this was funny, you know, that he was this young man, basically pulling his older teacher out of poetic ostrich mode. And I'm so glad too that with the book we have together, we had the opportunity to work on it together while he was alive, and to go back and forth and think about what the book would be. And I guess I can only hope that, having had to finish the book myself, that Max would approve of it.
You know, at one point, Max expressed his fear of dying, and you wrote a wonderful letter to him telling of a dream you had had about dying and what it meant to you, and you offered to listen if he ever wanted to talk with you about dying. How long was it before he responded to that letter, Sarah?
Well, the amazing thing was that he took a whole year to respond, and within that year, of course, we saw each other, we had other communications, but he didn't address that particular letter. And I think it was because he couldn't look at mortality in the face at that point. And the reason I had written him the letter was he told me at lunch that he was afraid to die. And that's why I wrote the letter, which has to do with, I mean, there's one anecdote about when I was in a car accident and blacked out and I thought I was dying. And it actually, it felt okay. You know, it felt like, okay, this is how death comes quickly. I felt I could, it wasn't scary. And I talk about a dream I had about my father, and, you know, I don't need to go into the specifics, but it was meant to be comforting, and Max waited a year and then wrote back a really beautiful letter. But I feel like, you know, with young people approaching death, or really anyone who's close to you is approaching death, we don't want to admit that the person's going to die. So sometimes it's taboo to talk about death
right.
with them.
Right.
And I felt like if I could be that person in Max's life who was willing to talk about it, that I was happy to do that.
You know, if you could carry only one memory of Max with you for the rest of your life, what's it going to be?
That's such a good question. I think it might be that reading at 13th Street Rep, watching him circle and read wearing a pink kimono. That might be the image.
A pink kimono. Why not, right? Yeah. Well, Sarah Rule is the co-author of Letters from Max, A Book of Friendship. It's at bookstores now, and you can also find it at milkweed.org. Sarah, you were a great interview, and I wish I could have met Max. What a great story you've told, and what a great thing you've done here. I sure appreciate you taking some time with us.
Oh, it's my privilege. Thank you.
All the best to you, Sarah.
You too.
That conversation with Sarah Rule first aired in November 2018. It's been 50 years since the preview of The Wild Bunch in a Kansas City movie theater. Learn why the film became a cinema icon. Hear that conversation and others at kcur.org/uptodate. Find and follow us on Twitter. We're at kcuruptodate. You can follow me at Steve Kraske. And don't forget to like KCUR on Facebook. Monday, meet the 9-year-old who wanted to make sure her classmates understood her little brother's disorder. Our theme music is composed by the great Bobby Watson. We had help this week from Linda Scher, Maria Carter, Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Devin Davis, and Elizabeth Ruiz. Have a great weekend, all. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.